Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Risky Business 331, brought to you this week by Microsoft. There's no intro music in this week's show as a mark of respect and mourning for Marco Agrippling, a consultant with Context Information Security's Melbourne office, who was unfortunately on board Malaysia flight MH17 when it was shot down over Ukraine. I can't say I knew Marco, but I've seen pictures of him and he does look extremely familiar. He was at RuxCon last year, apparently, so, you know, it makes sense. It's a pretty small community in Australia. This whole thing has just been awful for his friends and colleagues, and you can only imagine what his wife is feeling at the moment. They had travelled together, apparently, to Europe, but she took an earlier flight home. Now, I'm also told Marco was a very quiet and private person, so out of respect for that, I'm going to end these comments now. But yeah, my thoughts are with all of you out there who knew him and who miss him. And as for the sticks who shot down that plane, from the people who supplied the weapons to the incompetent idiots who pressed the button and pretty much everyone involved from the top on down, go eat a bag of dicks. This was an avoidable tragedy. Go eat a big bag of dicks and then just hang your heads. What a horrible waste. Now, in the meantime, the show must go on and will go on. And in this week's feature interview, we are chatting with our good pal, The Gruck, about the Tails bug that wasn't actually a Tails bug, and that Tor Talk that got pulled from Black Hat over legal concerns. But before we get into that, of course, we're going to check the week's news headlines with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, a researcher, has uncovered some quite spy-like features in Apple's iOS operating system, but Apple are like, hey, it's for diagnostics, nothing to worry about here. Just look over there, squirrel.
Yes, we've seen quite a bit of, I guess, brouhaha is a good word for the Register headline about spyware features or engineering features that are useful for data collection in Apple iOS. There was a presentation by a guy called Jonathan Zdziarski, where he talked about a number of features of iOS that are useful for forensics and data acquisition and potentially for spying on the users of iOS devices, either by Apple or by somebody else abusing that functionality. And this includes, functionality for like packet sniffing and features that allow you to get data out of the file system that didn't necessarily get encrypted with the user's passphrase, that kind of thing. But all of these attacks it basically requires some degree of physical access to the phone initially to set up, even though they can then be used remotely. And this is, we've seen a lot of, fairly sensationalistic headlines come out of this this story over the last week.
I guess the upshot here is that perhaps the encryption isn't as complete as they said it was, or does it really require tampering before you can actually recover stuff? Like, say I get arrested for, stabbing some idiot in the face because he's an idiot and I didn't like his face, and then the cops take my phone, can they then use what's in this research paper to recover more information than they would have previously, or...?
That seems to be the case, yeah. Or it there's a number of components that have been talked about. One is the packet capture. One is another one that is kind of provides access to file metadata, but also gets contents of caches and that kind of thing, and can do so without the encryption. And that's in the case where your phone is seized. Generally, your phone's going to be powered on and unlocked. Well, I mean, unlocked in the sense that you booted it, not unlocked in the sense that it's on the lock screen. And then from there, they can get access to a bunch of information. Now, whether or not these things are used by the forensics tools that you would expect in that case or not, it's not quite clear. But certainly it provides a number of very useful tools if you're building forensic tools for iOS.
So should we be a little bit annoyed at Apple over this, or should we just say, well, or is it one of those well-duh sort of situations?
Apple is certainly asserting in their response that these are just, legitimate engineering features, and, maybe they didn't document them as well as they could have, but that this, it's just engineering. It's not actually, malicious in any way, which, is entirely reasonable, I guess.
So perhaps not the scandal that some outlets are making it out to be.
No, certainly the scandal aspect has been well and truly played up. And, both Apple and the researcher in question have come out and said, that's not the case. Like, it's not meant to be, this is not NSA backdoor. Although, Jonathan Zdziarski did draw quite direct parallels between the capability of these backdoor components and the NSA dropout Jeep iOS Trojan. So, draw from that what you will.
Oh, what are you trying to imply there? Yeah. Oh, Adam, in some other news, Dan Bernstein and co. have released a paper about elliptic curve cryptography that is getting an awful lot of attention.
Yeah, this paper's called How to Manipulate Curve Standards, a white paper for the black hat. And it covers off basically the process by which you would go about designing the input curves that are a part of, you know, elliptic curve cryptography to exploit the fact that you had some secret backdoor property in those elliptic curves. So the elliptic curve cryptography is relatively complicated. I don't understand all of the crypto details, but essentially...
As far as I'm concerned, it's basically just magic.
it is basically magic. But I mean, the guts is there are a set of defined curves, which are one of the important properties, one of the important inputs to the algorithm, and that these curves are standardized and everyone who uses interoperable elliptic curve cryptography uses the same curves. And these curves come out of a magic standards process without any real explanation of where the curves came from. And this paper goes through the way that you would pick a curve to exploit some, you know, attack that you knew about based on properties of the curves that people were using it didn't, and how to do so in a way that, isn't obvious to everyone else looking at it what's going on. And that's a really interesting... it's an interesting example of how to attack, really one of the fundamental bits of, what is now the, sort of the premier way of doing cryptography. Now the RSA is falling out of favor. It's a very, very interesting, very deep and, detailed read. And the maths went straight over my head. But at the very least, it gets the award for most snarky academic style paper of the year, because it is actually quite hilarious reading.
What does this mean for people who are actually using elliptic curve, cryptography? Does this mean they have to be careful about selecting a supplier that they know isn't trojaning these curves? Because I imagine these curves are determined by the people who are doing the implementations of this stuff, right?
Well, they're determined by the standards body. So, NIST or the ANSI standard people, or there's a number of different standardized curves. We just kind of have to take it on faith that those curves are acting in our best interests. And I think, given what we know about the NSA and I guess NIST recently, that's not necessarily an assertion we can rely on. And you only have to look as far back as DES, right, to look at the way that the S-boxes were specifically manipulated, in this case, to improve the robustness of the algorithm to a type of cryptanalysis that the NSA knew about and we didn't. So there's absolutely precedent for this kind of thing. We have to assume that they're operating in our best interest. And as users of cryptography, elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman is what we've been promoting. I mean, you and I have been promoting for forward secrecy in TLS, right? We all use this kind of stuff, and we just have to kind of take it on faith that the standards bodies are working towards our best interest. And
what's the solution?
Dan Bernstein has opinions.
Well, what sort of solution do we have here? Do we get together a bunch of cryptographers who work in academia and get them to design these curves and say, we know that these are good? I mean, how can you actually restore trust in this particular technology?
Well, one of the suggestions is that we derive the curves from a specific, mathematical constants that in theory are going to be free of backdoors. So like Euler's number or pi or something like that, that we assume the NSA hasn't had a chance to backdoor pi, that kind of thing. But this paper actually goes into a method to do
exactly
that.
You never know,
that.
Man. They're pretty crafty.
honestly, I read the paper and I'm not quite clear what we're supposed to do about it other than cry. I don't know. Beyond that, crying is crying and drinking.
Okay, well, that paper is, by the sounds of things, confirmed as a pretty big deal. There is a link to it in this week's show notes. Please do go check it out if you would like. Moving on, and Edward Snowden has done an interview with Daniel Ellsberg, I think, at the Hope Conference, and said that he really wants to work on building anti-surveillance tech, which I guess isn't really much of a surprise. But it'll be interesting to see him actually doing some, like, GitHub commits, E-Snowden or something,
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, no one is surprised that he wants to work on privacy technology. I think that's, not exactly a news headline, but yeah, it's going to be interesting to see him actually contributing and doing some, committing some code, as you say. That'll be an interesting outcome to this whole story.
Well, I'm not even sure if that's what he has in mind, but certainly he's decided that while he's in exile, that's the direction he wants to push in. So good for him. And a couple of guys who, perhaps unexpectedly have come together to launch a mail system which more or less is designed to minimize the amount of metadata sort of generated and stored. It's Stephen Watt, who many people might remember went to prison for a couple of years based on helping Albert Gonzalez build a tool that he used for sniffing credit cards off the wire. He's been out of prison for quite some time now. He's teamed up with Ladar Levison, and they're founding this company called Darkmail, which could be very interesting. Although I'm very wary of things that say they want to replace email. I mean, Google tried that with God, I can't even remember the name of it now, and that didn't work out.
Wave.
Wave, yeah.
Google, Wave, Google. That's it, yeah.
The mail product only people with, you know, three PhDs could figure out how to use. And yeah, so I'm wary of people when they team up and say, yeah, we're gonna do something that replaces email, but it looks like an interesting project.
Yeah, as you say, like replacing email is a pretty big ask just because it's so entrenched and, you know, predates the internet kind of thing. But no, they're attempting to build a mail solution that's going to provide a bunch of the crypto functionality of PGP, right? I mean, solve the user interface problem of PGP, but at the same time also, you know, work on the wire mail protocols and sort of onion routing for mail, in many ways reminiscent of some of the mail forwarding and mail anonymity systems we've seen in the past that, you know, trying to bring that all together into a thing that defeats both meta-route analysis and content analysis for a mail system, you know, whether or not that ends up being a useful thing or whether it's just, you know, contributes to that general body of work will have to remain to be seen. But, you know, certainly, you know, old Stephen Watt, the Unix terrorist, knows a few things about coding security stuff. So, you know, we may see some things come out of that.
Well, and it's good to see someone who did have such a major setback, you know, basically getting out there and, you know, really getting involved in something like this. So good for him.
Yeah, exactly. Agreed. I concur.
Now, Adam, over the last couple of weeks, we've been talking a lot about this LZO, you know, Linux bug, which is, you know, going to be around for a long time and is actually kind of a big deal. Some people have put together a payload generator, which is really slick for this particular bug.
Yeah, it's quite funny. The LZO bug has been getting a lot of traction. Of course, the main case in which we've seen it actually been exploited is with media files and the one of the Linux, you know, like video file rendering tool chains. Anyways, they put together, these people put together a payload generator where you upload your shellcode, you upload your video, you select exactly which target you'd like it to have code exec on, and you hit the button and you receive a malicious video file, which is as you say, pretty slick. But the question, I suppose, is whether we're going to see more widespread exploitation of this in other cases. I mean, this has been the main one, the video files, but of course the LZO algorithm is all over the place, and that's why this bug is interesting, because we don't know exactly how many places it's going to crop up, but certainly this particular case is well sewn up by this exploit generator.
Yeah, I mean, at the moment it's, you know, hitting stuff like Debian, FreeBSD, OpenSUSE, you know, Ubuntu, all of your sort of big distros, but you got to imagine that it's going to be easy enough to patch in your average Linux desktop distro. It's going to be those, you know, Internet of Things that are going to have trouble, you would think, right?
Yeah, although this bug has been getting kind of less exploitability, or it has been not exploitable in more of the cases than you would expect, I think. I mean, the, you know, bugs like this are always difficult to triage, I suppose, because you don't know how difficult it's going to be in each of the cases to exploit. But I'm surprised that we haven't seen more exploitation yet, given, you know, quite how widespread it plausibly is. But yeah, it's the embedded systems and all the weird edge cases that we'll be living with for years. You know, much like Heartbleed, I suppose, is a good comparison that will keep us, you know, keep our security guys in business for some time to come, probably.
Now, there's some interesting stuff coming up at Black Hat about how third-party software libraries can introduce serious vulnerabilities into other software, which is a worthy topic.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, man, the LZO bug, Heartbleed are both really good examples of bugs in embedded libraries that either get, you know, linked in at a compile time and shipped, or, you know, are runtime linked, that people really don't think about. And when you're building commercial software, you know, often the people who are going to be doing the security response later on, you know, don't necessarily know all of the little bits of third-party library code that are embedded in it that, you know, the developers picked, you know, off the public domain shelf, you know, 10 years ago or something. So it is a really worthwhile thing that, you know, needs a bit more exploration. And when we've seen bugs in, you know, libtiff and the PNG and libjpeg, ffmpeg, all these kind of things that are just, you know, sort of guts of complex input parsing be exploited in the past, and are really kind of trying to catalog this and bring it out into the open a bit more would be good. And, you know, we're seeing that, I guess, with some of Google's work to look at software that's used in internet infrastructure that isn't, you know, well loved and maintained. I mean, OpenSSL being the best example. Yeah, this kind of thing is, it's good to see it getting more focus.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that in particular, because we also had the news this week that Google has shipped Boring SSL, which is its OpenSSL fork. You know, they've already put that in Chrome. So that's a good thing, you'd think.
Yes, you know, I think it is, right? That's Google actually solving the pragmatic problem, you know, rather than getting too hung up on open source politics.
Chris Valasek and Charlie Miller, of course, are well known for doing their research into, you know, hacking cars and, you know, rigging them up to be controlled by Nintendo controllers and stuff, all that fun stuff. They've now come up with basically what amounts to a, you know, a firewall for cars for the OBD network. So that looks kind of cool, right?
Yeah, they put together a prototype device that plugs into the ODB port of your car and it acts like an anomaly detection IPS. So it profiles normal operation of the car's CAN bus. And then when it sees something weird going on, attempts to shut down all of the fancy features of the car. So like things other than the gas and the brakes, pretty much, until you power cycle the car to try and stop you getting on. And it's not really intended as a real actual thing. Like they're not kickstarting it and selling it or anything, but as a demonstration of the kind of things that you can do to prevent car attacks. But I think it's mostly a party trick, right?
I don't know that it's a party trick. I think they're trying to prove a point, because I had Charlie Miller on the show a couple of months back talking about this stuff, and he said really stopping these attacks, they're flooding attacks, right? And they're very easy to detect. They stick out like the dog's proverbials, and shutting them down isn't hard. So I think for them building, you know, something in $150 worth of parts that they bought retail, it wouldn't be terribly difficult for the manufacturers of these types of vehicles to, you know, put something in the car for a great deal less and just sort of neutralize the whole issue. So I think, you know, it seems like that's more the spirit in which they've done this.
Yeah, although, I mean, of course, the devil is very much in the details. And there's a big difference between a proof of concept that works well enough versus something you're actually going to want to put in your car. Although that said, I mean, given the rubbish the manufacturers put in the car in the first place, then, you know, maybe I'm being too generous.
Now, we've seen a lot of talk over the years about cookies and privacy and do not track and all this sort of stuff. But, you know, there's some really interesting tracking techniques evolving at the moment. And one of them involves fingerprinting. And we've just seen a study from Princeton University and the KU Leuven in Belgium actually released on this. And it makes for some pretty interesting reading.
Yeah, this is about doing browser fingerprinting using the canvas tag. So basically you get the browser to render a bunch of stuff to an off-screen canvas and then pull the pixels out and take a hash of them. And then the idea is that, you know, by rendering specific data about the browser and then relying on like the font rendering and other, you know, specifics of the browser's runtime, that you end up with a unique fingerprint. And then by repeating that process, you can identify individual people again. And this was a research technique we'd seen talked about a few years back, but it's actually been deployed by some ad network to the extent that like the front page of whitehouse.gov is actually canvas fingerprinting people now.
That is not creepy at all.
Which just goes to show like how quickly this stuff goes from, you know, obscure a research trick to, you know, in use.
Well, when it has you know, such obvious commercial applications, you know, that's obviously what's going to happen. But I mean, is there any way that we can, as privacy conscious people, I can't really imagine that this provides consumers with a benefit that absolutely love. I mean, if they're the sort of people who are, you know, taking steps to not be tracked via cookies and stuff, then they're not going to be too happy about this. Is it an easy thing to stop? Can you stop your browser being profiled in this way, in an easy way, or would it be easy for browser manufacturers to build something in that would make this more difficult?
Well, I think they have tried to, right? We've got anti-tracking mechanisms and do not track headers and things that we can use to indicate our wishes to the, you know, web server and the people tracking us. It doesn't make any difference, right? The only thing we can actually do, right, we can't win the technical arms race. The only thing we can actually do is not buy things from people who advertise stuff to us on the internet, which...
But most people don't know. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, like, they just don't know. So I'm just wondering if there could be some sort of, you know, checkbox option. I mean, we've seen Apple releasing, I mean, they're going to release iOS 8 with randomized MAC addresses for SSID probes, right? And that's an anti-tracking measure. Could we see browsers actually shipping with something that would fool this? Will it be easy to fool, or is this rendering technique always going to work?
There are some browsers. Apparently, there's an EFF browser extension called Privacy Badger that has some ability to kind of stop this kind of thing. Similarly, the Tor browser has some countermeasures, but this is a technical arms race that's always, you know, that we're always going to be on the losing side of, because the, you know, the ad tracking companies are incentivized by their business model to do this. And, you know, we have to react to that. So we're always going to be on the losing side, I think, sadly.
Cool. I'm going to move to a log cabin. Catch you all later.
Basically, right?
All right. Now, this is my favorite story of the week. It's by Andy Greenberg, and it's running on Wired. Some dudes figured out something really, like, quite fun, which is, you know, a lot of these companies like Amazon Web Services and a lot of these, like, cloud computing companies give you, like, a free instance for, like, a trial period. So these guys have basically scripted the signups and then used instances to mine Bitcoin. And it works pretty good. And they're not even sure that it's illegal. So yay for them.
It's a great write-up. They automated the sign-up of something like 150 different cloud service providers. And then they were actually mining Litecoin, because mining Bitcoin on CPU is just not a thing anymore. But Litecoin is designed to allow you to mine it effectively on a CPU. And they were generating something like, potentially a $1,700 a week worth of Litecoin using their, I was going to say stolen botnet, but it's not really stolen. It's sort of a,
They didn't steal it, but it did fall off the back of a truck.
Yeah, their free trial botnet. Yeah. Yeah, which is good. You know, it's a good example of, practical research on the internet for something, that you could really see real attackers getting on board with. I mean, it's better than having to, own tens of thousands of people's, links as routers or something when you can actually have real instances on Amazon and Heroku and that kind of thing.
Yeah, but what are they going to do about it? That's the problem, right? Like, without actually restricting the free signups, I suppose you could demand a valid credit card number or $1 charge or something like that, couldn't you? But I fail to see how they're going to stop this without changing their actual business process in some way, and that's a pain in the ass.
Yeah, and I think a few of them have changed their process as a result of this kind of thing. I know I've talked to people who work in cloud computing, and they've said yes, like, we just end up with jerks Bitcoin mining on our free instances, and that's just the cost of doing business for us. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's, as long as they sell enough cloud instances, doesn't really matter if some jerks from Bishop Fox are, mining Litecoin, then that's just the way it is on the internet, right?
That's how it rolls. Now, there's going to be some fun stuff at DEF CON. There is a router hacking competition targeting residential and SME wireless routers. And I think this is a really great idea because, they are just hideously bad. Every couple of weeks, we just see a raft of stories pointing out bugs. And, people are using those bugs because users don't notice when their home router is owned. So they get, really nice persistent access to these devices. So I reckon we're going to see some pretty hardcore shredding, and that might actually cause some of these manufacturers to lift their game, we'd hope.
Yeah, I think this is a great thing. This is it's called a So Hopelessly Broken, a SoHo, of course, being small office, home office. But, sort of in the proud tradition of the Race to Zero that Bogan ran a few years back for defeating antivirus, this kind of competition is good for raising the profile and solving a particular, industry's unwillingness to deal with its problems. And as you say, like, all of these consumer devices are complete rubbish. We saw internet scanning, internet census project that used, a botnet of hacked home devices to scan the entire internet. This stuff is actively exploited, and the vendors do need to take responsibility for their rubbish. So this is good.
In other news, the guys and gals at Citizen Lab have actually put out some really interesting research looking at internet filtering in Iraq, which, I can't say I'm terribly surprised that there is a lot of internet filtering going on in Iraq, considering the problems that country is experiencing with its security. I mean, this is just what happens. But there's a detail in this story that I found fascinating, which is this underground, offline chat app, which uses Bluetooth, has really taken off. And unfortunately, though, it sends messages in the clear. But I find the idea, the whole concept behind this distributed peer-to-peer Bluetooth messaging system absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, it is. It's a really interesting detail. This app's called Fire Chat, and it uses Bluetooth, and as you said, does kind of messaging. And I was immediately actually drawn to the story ran a while ago about John McAfee's distributed peer to peer anti censorship messaging system or file transfer system. There's certainly some similarities with that. Although it sounded like John McAfee was doing a better job than this particular Fire Chat app, which doesn't appear to have been, in his defense, doesn't appear to have been designed for this particular kind of adversarial use case. But yeah, increasingly this kind of off grid self community run messaging platform or communication platform to avoid censorship, right, is a natural response to this kind of thing. And
I'm just spinning out that we're sitting here saying, gee, John McAfee's idea was really good. just give me a moment to get past that. Yep, but anyway,
get past the mind.
Yeah. But it is fascinating stuff, and there's a link to that piece, a threat post, right up on the Citizen Lab research, and people can go through and have a look at it. But yeah, very interesting. It turns out that it's a pretty insecure way of doing things, but just a fascinating idea that you could spring up one of these sort of mesh networks run on you know, devices you put in your pocket. It's really interesting story for 2014. Our good friend Silvio Cesare has popped up in Wired talking about disabling home alarm systems. You know, fun research, 90s techniques applied to electronic devices that, you know, really should be a little bit better. Although I can't say, you know, if one of these was installed in my house, you know, the sort of person who's going to break into my house is not going to be rolling with, you know, a software-defined radio. They're going to come with a crowbar and, you know, just run away when the police come.
Well, exactly. I don't think all of the criminals in your hood are going to have the giant throbbing brain of Silvio Cesare and his, you know, wireless technique to hack you. But yes, obviously, if you use wirelessly connected motion sensors and door, you know, read switches or whatever to secure your house, then yes, someone can turn up with a radio jammer and mess with it, or even worse, replay commands to unlock your alarm system, which is, you know, what some of the research that Silvio has been doing. But yeah, it's... I mean, you know, consumer tech stuck in the 90s, you know, no real surprise there, although I suppose it's a surprise for people who've got this stuff in their house.
Well, it's just really good to see Silvio getting some big ink. Well done, man. Very good. Oh, now the European Central Bank, the ECB, apparently has had one of its databases owned. It was like a database linked to its website, according to CNET.
Yeah, it looks like someone popped at least a portion of their website and managed to lift the database of people who'd like signed up for conferences and stuff run by the ECB. So, you know, it's not like someone broke into their core central banking systems, although, you know, maybe they did and they're just not telling us. But yeah, ECB is presumably a little embarrassed about that.
Yeah, well, I think 20,000 email addresses for people who attend central bank conferences might have some relevance to the intelligence community. Pretty good spear phishing list, that one, if you're going after central banks and whatnot. Something like 50,000 sites have been owned through a WordPress plugin. I mean, you know, this is a headline we see so often.
Yeah, well, actually, didn't we talk about this last week? Although I think there's someone exploiting a bug that we did talk about last week, and it's actually the worm that's exploiting it is then owning other things virtual hosted on the same box. So we're seeing like Joomla sites owned by WordPress bugs because the WordPress blogs are on the same box as other people's Joomla sites and blah, blah, blah. But yes, WordPress boxes getting owned through unpatched WordPress plugins, you know, it could be any year from 2014 AD back to, you know, what, like 2004 AD.
And any year in the future to something like 2020, right? So, yeah, I think we talked about the bug last week, but yeah, I don't think, you know, that unleash the four horsemen of the whatever. There's been more malware circulating, which is using Tor for command and control. No surprises there. I mean, it's becoming quite a popular callback technique, and with good reason, you know?
Yeah, well, so this particular piece of crypto malware is interesting, actually, because it does use, like, good, strong elliptic curve cryptography, funnily enough, asymmetric elliptic curve cryptography to encrypt your data, and then actually has good crypto across Tor to go and talk back to the command and control system to, you know, accept your Bitcoin bounty or whatever. So it's nice to see the Russian, you know, cyber criminals, you know, using best-of-breed crypto technology instead of, you know, rubbish RSA, NSA backdoored crypto.
Now, a few other stories just to run through very quickly. Catch of the Day, which is an Australian, like, you know, deal of the day type of website, had apparently some data breach 3 years ago, and they're actually just coming public about that. Is that right?
It looks like it, yeah. They're asserting that it took them 3 years to come clean about the fact they had a breach because they weren't so worried about people cracking SHA-1 hashes 3 years ago, and then now because, like, GPUs or something, that it's a big deal 3 years later. And they broke the news on, like, a Friday afternoon just so that, you know, no one would really notice.
But, it's what we call in the media game, putting out the trash. Friday afternoon, that's what you do. Now, speaking of long delays until disclosure, Vupin dropped some IEO day at CanSec West back in March, but it turns out they'd been sitting on that bug for years.
Yeah, I know we're all very shocked that Vupin is sitting around on years old IEO day, but I guess they'd finished monetizing that one, or someone else had found it in parallel. Yeah, they dropped that one out. But yeah, the disclosure timeline, 3 years gap between between discovery and disclosed at Pwn2Own. So I'm sure they got their money's worth out of that one.
Yeah, they found their bug on 12th of February 2011, and it was patched by Microsoft on 17th of June 2014. So yeah. Oh, IBM's fixed a bunch of code execution and cookie stealing vulnerabilities in its KVM switches, which, I don't know how worried you got to be about that. And I'm going to end this week's news segment, Adam, with probably the biggest bit of fail in terms of technology journalism I've seen in, God, so many years. The headline reads, "Are you still running Windows XP? antivirus products put to the test. They're like, okay, so Microsoft's no longer supporting it. Here's how you can keep running XP. My God. My God.
Yeah, no, excellent, good quality, computer advice from ZDNet here, telling people that they should run good AV to protect themselves on XP. So what a bunch of champs.
I don't normally encourage people to commit crimes, but if someone could own their CMS and just replace the text of the article with the word no, that would be really, really sweet.
You can get the source code to CNET CMS from the Twitters. I am reliably informed.
We talked about that last week, didn't we? They wrote up the fact that someone had contacted them and were trying to shake them down for cash. And apparently it's their CMS sources everywhere.
Yeah, their CMS source showed up on Twitter the other day.
Oh, man.
It looks legit. So, yeah, enjoy. If you're looking for PHP bugs, then carry on.
I worked there a million years ago back in 03 and ZDNet Australia, and the CMS was just, it's horrible. I don't think you'd want the code unless they've updated it, which they probably have. I don't know, but maybe not as well, because things move slowly in that world. But anyway, so that's it, Adam, for this week's news. Thanks a lot for joining us, mate. And we will chat again next week.
Cheer, bro. Talk to you then.
Adam Boileau there with a check of the week's security news. Big thanks to him. Okay, next up we are chatting with the Gruck about some developments in the privacy tech arena. And it's funny because, Gruck has this reputation as being this like global cyber arms dealer baby killer guy, but he isn't actively involved in exploit broking anymore and has basically spent the last 7 or so months working for a major broadcaster on privacy tools for journalists. There's that. Some people have a bit of trouble wrapping their heads around that. Earlier this week, Twitter was abuzz with the talk of a serious bug in Tails, the, bootable on a disk or, on a CD or USB device OS used by pro-democracy activists. And of course, by pro-democracy activists, I mean, potheads buying a couple of ounces on Silk Road, but whatever. So yeah, there was a Tails bug that was going to be a big deal, right? Right? Well, maybe not. So we get the Gruck's thoughts on that. And I also spoke to him about a talk on unmasking Tor users being pulled from Black Hat pretty much at the last minute. So I had a Skype chat with Gruck and I started off by asking him to explain what Tails actually is for those of us who don't know much about it.
Tails is a version of, it's an old version of Debian that has been developed to run off of a USB stick or a CD. So it's a live distro. And it automatically routes everything over Tor. And additionally, it doesn't save anything to disk. So the idea is that if you are someone who values anonymity and privacy, you would install Tails on a USB, and you would use this as your default work and communications platform.
I'm sure that's very useful, which just means you have to keep all of your work and communications in the cloud, and there's no privacy problems with that whatsoever, right?
Right. Well, they do have a way of installing things to disk, which then sort of starts to defeat their security model a little bit. Yeah, a lot of the problems I have with it actually are that it doesn't use GRSec, so it's not secure against exploits.
They're just hardening patches, right, GRSec?
GRSec uses quite a lot of anti-exploitation hardening to the system, and it makes it very, very robust against ODAs and unknown attacks, or even known attacks that you can take your time patching for. With a live distro, patches aren't actually pushed out because you can't save them to disk. So you'd have to re-image. So you have to get a new image every time. And they push these out every couple of months. So, every couple of months you're downloading 700 megs of data from a site that we know is monitored by the NSA. So this is a great way of showing that you are
shifty and suspicious.
if you want people to pay attention to you, download Tails every couple of months.
Okay, now I know people are listening to this right now and they're thinking, okay, sounds great. What could possibly go wrong? And yet something has. We've heard a lot of talk about this bug in Tails, apparently. There's been a lot of people talking about a big bug in Tails, awful bug in Tails. It's all over for Tails. Is it over for Tails? Because apparently it's not over for Tails.
Yeah, so there might have been a little bit of hyperbole in that. The big Tails bug turns out to be a big I2P bug. And if you've never heard of I2P, join the rest of everyone that uses Tails.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because by default, all of your traffic through Tails goes through Tor, but there is a non-default configuration that where you can actually use I2P instead of Tor, and I2P, of course, is an alternative anonymity network that, you know, depending on who you listen to, is either really awesome or just horrifyingly bad.
Yeah, so I like the model that I2P uses. Like, it's designed to deal with a global passive adversary. The problem is it's not really up to the task the way that it is now. I mean, as we see, there's bugs that should have been caught. I mean, a cross-site configuration scripting, like XSS on JavaScript on, you know, a default install, is, that's embarrassing. Like, you don't get to a version after several years of this with, you know, a game over bug in cross-site scripting.
Well, apparently the reason the Tails guys and gals disabled I2P by default was because their whole rationale was because the client was probably full of bugs, right? And it turns out they're right, and they're still wearing a bucket of shit on the internet this week, right? So it doesn't really seem fair to them, does it?
Yeah, no, I mean, like, the Tails guys got a lot of shit for something that they obviously they put in because someone said, why don't you have I2P? And they were like, okay, fine, we'll have I2P, but we're not the same. Like,
we'll bury it beneath about 6 million menu options before you can turn it on.
Yeah, we don't trust this. It's off by default. And then what happens? Oh my God, Tails is broken. Something that's off by default, buried under 6 menus options. You know.
Yeah, but now we know that it's a bug in I2P. What sort of bug is this and how bad is it? I mean, you know, there's like 30,000 I2P users in the world, right? So not many people actually care. I imagine this is the sort of thing that's just going to get patched and we can all just forget about it?
So what's been tweeted so far from the I2P developer accounts is that this is a cross-site scripting bug and it requires JavaScript enabled by default, which happens to be the default with Tails, a very bizarre security configuration that no one's ever really explained. So it looks like a standard cross-site scripting attack. You've got JavaScript enabled, you get owned, your IP gets leaked, end of story. Something that should have really been fixed with a source code audit would be my guess. The question is, it's very hard to tell, how do you go from JavaScript to direct access over IP? And that's what we'd like to know. They don't seem to have leaked any of that information. Clearly, that's what's going to get fixed by the I2P guys. And, you know, now that they fixed the one bug, it will be rock solid again.
Hooray!
I mean, one of the reasons that there are so few I2P users is that it's actually incredibly slow. Like, once you enable it, it can take up to 30 minutes before you get a connection.
Mm.
Right? This is... like, if you're at a coffee shop, they're going to
kick you
out.
Hang on, I'm just going to check my email, yeah.
Yeah. They'll kick you out after you finish your coffee and you still haven't connected. You know, like, this is not really the sort of low latency network that you want to use for privacy. This is, like, the model is great. The problem is that, you know, as we've seen, the clients and so on, the source code hasn't been audited. But the other problem is that there just isn't enough mass behind it. Like, it doesn't have the critical mass that Tor does. It doesn't have people renting very, very big servers and donating bandwidth, which, you know, it clearly needs if it's going to have any of the usability that Tor has. So while I like the idea of I2P, I do not actually like I2P.
Now, look, it's not just Tails that are getting a rough go of it lately. Of course, there was some big news over the last week or so where there was this talk scheduled for Black Hat about de-anonymizing Tor users with a $3,000 budget. And in fact, Adam and I, before last week's show, said, because we'd sort of missed it when the announcement was first made. And I brought it up and I said, look, do we talk about it now or do we wait until they've actually demoed it? And, you know, we came to the conclusion of PCAPs or it didn't happen. We wanted to see what they've got. Yeah. And now, of course, we're not going to get to see it because the research has been pulled. It was researchers from Carnegie Mellon University, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And it looks like it's pretty much a mystery at this point, but it looks like what's happened is that the university has stepped in and said, there is no way in hell we want to be known as the people that, you know, broke Tor and put all of these wonderful democracy activists in jail for possession of an ounce of democracy.
That's right. That's right. So it looks like the legal unit or some legal department at Carnegie Mellon has come forward and said, you know, whoa. And I'm guessing that this might have something to do with their research I'm guessing, you know, there could be some concerns with the legality of the research, because any type of attack like this, you're pretty much intercepting packets that weren't really meant for you, weren't you?
Yeah. No, as soon as you start doing sort of wiretapping on your own, you're in very, very dodgy territory, particularly in the US, which does not like individuals to do their own wiretapping. So it's likely that they did their attack against the live network rather than one in the lab. And the reason for that, of course, is that doing a demo in a lab, it's not very satisfying and it's not necessarily conclusive proof. So my guess is they did it live. They said, this thing works. This is great. Let's do our talk. They pumped out a bit of publicity. The Tor people went nuts. The university heard about it and went, are you f***ing kidding me? You wiretapped the public?
Yeah.
You know, this, did you get response, like, did you get legal forms saying that you were allowed to do this? Like,
I mean,
you
know, we should
thinking?
We yeah. should point out that this is purely speculation on our part. I mean, for all we know,
right.
They worked in very close consultation with their legal department, so we just don't know. And I imagine that, yeah. you know, more and more details will become public, so we should say that this is just speculation,
yeah,
but it looks like
definitely.
Yeah, yeah, based on comments that are coming out of the Tor camp, though, it looks like this wasn't some sort of generic attack against the very, you know, architecture that is Tor. It looks like it did rely on a vulnerability, because the Tor people are saying that it is being patched and you know, isn't really going to be a problem in future. Of course, when Tor is patched, it takes a while for that patch to propagate through the ecosystem. So I'm sure they're going to appreciate the extra time they're getting now that the Tor has been pulled, I imagine.
Yeah. No, there's already been people on the mailing list saying, when are we going to get a patch that we can push out? And they're saying so apparently the researchers on Tor still haven't exchanged specific information. The Tor people have said that they have taken the hints that have been received. They've looked into it. They think they found a bug. It looks like a good bug. They're going to be patching it. They're going to be pushing it out. So probably in a few weeks or a month or so, most of the Tor servers should be updated to the new patched version that fixes a bug that we don't know, you know, what it is or how it works. What was interesting was Dan Kaminsky had spoken to Robert Dingeldine, the head of the Tor project, and he says that apparently the bug that's been patched is one that does require extended periods of time to start unmasking. So,
yeah, I think they mentioned something like $3,000 in 2 months. But, I mean, what does that tell us about the nature of this attack? What is the $3,000 going to be used for? I can only assume that's going to be an absolute crap ton of Amazon Web Service, like EC2 instances, right?
Yeah, that would be my guess. I think they would just be using it to rent a large number of boxes. My suspicion is that they found a way of forcing certain nodes to be used rather than other nodes, so that they could end up having control over both an entry and an exit at some point. And that's why they need a large amount of time, because it takes people using the Tor daemon for large periods of time to build up the sort of history to be able to be identified, you know, over a stretch of time. If you're continually using the same set of entry and exit nodes, then you start to stand out. So I think they've just found a way of tricking the protocol a little bit to force it to have, say, a preference for certain nodes.
Do you think there are generic attacks out there, though, that are going to really sort of fundamentally threaten the viability of Tor as a decent protection?
So basically, the theory of Tor is pretty sound. It's if you have an entry node, a middle node, and an exit node, and none of them are associated with each other in the same country, people can't get the logs on them, then it's possible that you can route data through these three nodes and you completely clean yourself. It's basically a surveillance detection route that completely sanitizes data, unless there is a global passive adversary, someone that can monitor all traffic on the internet. And as we know, there's someone that monitors, you know, 80% of the traffic on the internet.
Doing that retrospectively, though, would be a little bit difficult, wouldn't it?
Yes. Yeah. No, I don't think Tor is fundamentally broken. I do think if you rely exclusively on Tor, you're setting yourself up for failure, because you have a single point of failure. Right? Even if it is very, very robust, I would never say just use Tor and you're safe.
All right, well, Gruk, thank you very much for joining us to have a bit of a chat about, you know, these interesting little attacks against all things anonymizing. Great to chat to you, mate. I'm sure we'll speak to you again soon.
Good to talk to you too, mate. Catch you later.
The Gruck there with a chat about Tails, I2P, and Tor, and that is it for this week's show. This week's show is brought to you by Microsoft, but at the last minute, the spokesperson they had available couldn't actually do the interview. So alas, this week's show is sponsored, but doesn't have a sponsor interview. But I would like to take a minute now to plug something they're doing that is really worthwhile. It's called Interflow, and it's basically for incident responders. So think of it as a massive platform for threat intelligence sharing that's backed by Microsoft. They've been doing really good stuff in the IR area, particularly in the last couple of years, and this is just another good initiative. So if you are in incident response, do check out microsoft.com/interflow. Go have a look. I think it's in private preview mode now, which I think is a PR safe term for beta. But yeah, go check it out. And if you like it, do sign up. So that's it for this week's show. Next week's show should be an absolute cracker. I'll be at Splendor in the Grass tomorrow, which is a big music festival here in Australia. So tomorrow being Saturday, July 26th. And I'm hosting a panel there in the forum tent featuring Sulet Dreyfus, NSA whistleblower Thomas Drake, Jesselyn Radack, and WA Senator Scott Ludlam. So I'll be recording that panel and maybe doing some interviews also. So I should have some really good material for next week's show. Now, I am told that Marco Grippeling was a Risky Business listener, so I'm going to play a track. This week's feature track, I'm told he would love to have heard played on the show. So apparently Marco saw Slayer in Europe about a million years ago before they were sort of widely known, and there were only like 30 people in the room. So he's kind of like a metal hipster. He was into them before they were cool. And this track is called Angel of Death by Slayer. And while I feared it's probably not the most appropriate track for the circumstances, I am told by his colleagues it was his favorite song from the album, Rain and Blood. And he would have got a real kick out of hearing it at the end of this program. And all Slayer's friggin' songs are about death anyway, so there's that. So this one is dedicated to Marco. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.